In the same way, when you get to the astral world first you are quite naked just as you are when you come to the earth, and then you think what sort of clothes you are going to wear. You don't have to wear clothes, but most people do for some strange reason, and one can see the most remarkable collection of garments because each person makes their own clothes according to any style they are thinking about. In the same way, they build their houses in any style they are thinking about. There are no cars, of course, and no buses, and no trains. You don't need them. Why be cluttered by a car when you can move as fast as you wish by wishing? So, by thought power alone you can visit any part of the astral world. In the astral there are many jobs that one can do. You can be a helper to those who are every second arriving from the earth, you can do nursing, you can do healing, because many of those who arrive from the earth are not aware of the reality of the astral and they believe whatever their religion has taught them to believe. Or, if they are atheists they believe in nothing, and so they are enshrouded in a black, black fog, a fog that is sticky and confusing, and until they can acquire some sort of understanding that they are blinded by their own folly they cannot be helped much, so attendants follow them around and try to break away the fog. Then there are those who counsel the astral people who have to return to Earth. Where do they want to go? What sort of parents do they want? What sort of family conditions, a rich family or a poor family? What sort of conditions will enable them to do the tasks which they plan to do? It all looks so easy when in the astral world, but it is not always so easy when one is on the Earth, you know. In the lower astral people often eat. They can smoke also if they want to. Whatever they want to eat is actually manufactured from the atmosphere by thought, not so amazing when you think of prana which is believed in implicitly on earth. So you can eat what you wish, you can drink what you wish also, but actually all that is just folly because one is acquiring all the energy, all the sustenance from the atmospheric radiations and eating and drinking is just a habit. One soon shucks off those habits and is the better for it. You can take it, then, that one does much the same in the lower astral as one does upon the earth. Yes, Mrs. So-and-so, there is a sex life in the astral as well, but it is far, far better than anything you can ever experience on the earth because you have such an enhanced range of sensations. So if you have not had much of a balanced sex life on earth remember that in the astral you will have, because it is necessary to make a balanced person. Of course the higher one rises in the astral world, that is the more one increases one's personal vibrations, then the better the experiences, the more pleasant they become, and the more satisfying the whole existence becomes. Many people on earth are all members of a group. You may have for example, and for example only, 10 people who together really complete one astral entity. On the earth we have these 10 people, and perhaps 3, 4, 5, or 6 die. Well, the person who is in the astral does not become really complete until all the group are united. It is very difficult explaining such a thing because it involves different dimensions which are not even known upon this earth, but you have felt a remarkable affinity with a certain person, a person who, of course, is absolutely separate from you. You may have thought how compatible you were with that person, you may feel a sense of loss when that person goes away. Well, quite possibly that person is a member of your group and when you die to this earth you will be united together as one entity. Upon the earth all these people are like tentacles reaching out to get different sensations, different experiences during that brief flickering of consciousness which comprises a lifetime upon earth. Yet when all the members of that group, when all the tentacles are pulled in, one has in effect the experience of perhaps 10 lifetimes in one. One has to come to earth to learn the hard material things because there are no such experiences in the astral world. Not everyone is a member of a group, you know, but you probably know whole groups of people who just cannot manage without each other. It may be members of a big family, they are always dashing around to see how the others are doing. And even when they marry they still have to forsake their partners at times and rush back home as if they are all going in like a lot of chickens under the old hen. Many people are individualists, not members of a group upon the earth, they have come to do certain things alone and they rise or fall by their own efforts on the earth. The poor souls often have a very bad time indeed upon the earth, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they have immense karmic debts because they get suffering, it means that they are doing special work and incurring good karma for a few lives to come. Really experienced people can tell what other people have been in a past life, but don't believe the advertisement you read where, for a small sum of money, you can have all your past incarnations told. Don't believe that for a moment because most of these people who make such claims are fakes. If they demand money for such a service, then you can be sure that they are fakes, because the really trained person does not take money for these occult purposes as it lowers the personal vibrations. It is such a tragic thing that so many advertisements appear which aren't fakes. People flit about examining the Akashic record or looking into the past to see what you did wrong, or looking a bit forward to see what you did right, provided you pay enough money. And then all these cults who teach you the mystery of the ages provided you pay a monthly sum for the rest of your life. Some of these are just ordinary commercial correspondence colleges. They want your money, possibly they might do some good, they might teach you not to believe all advertisements, for example. But my own point of view is this: if a person advertises in glamorous terms what he or she can do for you for a small outlay, well, be suspicious. If these people could do it, they would do it for themselves and get money and power that way. The fact that they have to run a correspondence course or do this or that service, makes them, in my opinion, suspect, and I sincerely wish that there was some way in which these advertisements could be censored and controlled. There are many, many people who are utterly genuine, but my own personal experience is that it is rare indeed for such a person to advertise. Remember also that people who make these wondrous claims about how they go into the astral for you and look at all your records, etc., etc., well, you can't prove them really wrong, can you? Just the same as you can't prove them right. So, just to be on the safe side, it is far better not to bother with people who advertise as such, but instead meditate, because if you meditate you can get the results you want. You know yourself better than any other person, and most assuredly you know yourself better than a person who is going to charge you a couple of dollars for this or that service. Most times all he does is to put a pre-printed form in an envelope and mail it to you under the heading of strictly private and personal. Here is another sad little extract from a letter. I recently lost a friend of many years. My little pet died and I am broken-hearted and wondering. My parish priest told me that I was a bad woman to dare to suggest that animals have souls. He said that only humans have souls, and more or less implied that only those humans who belong to his own branch of the church. Can you give me any hope that I will see my beloved pet in another life? Some priests are real jackasses, you know. They are astonishingly ignorant men. It always amazes me. Well, let us take Christians. Christians almost go to war as to which sect is the true sect. Christians preaching Christianity do not show Christianity to Christians of another sect. Look at the Protestants and the Catholics. You would think they had bought up all the front row seats in heaven the way they go on. Catholics seem to think that Protestants are evil people, and Protestants are quite sure that Catholics are evil people. But that's not a matter of discussion at present. For centuries, asinine preachers have taught that man is the ultimate in development. They have taught that there cannot be anything higher than mankind, and mankind alone has a soul provided that they be of this or that specific religion. I say to you with absolute knowledge that, yes, animals also go to the astral world. Animals have the same opportunities as humans. I say to you, yes, you can meet beloved pets again, not merely when you yourself die to this earth, but now in astral travel to the zone in which those animals are. Only a natter fool, only a complete and absolute ignoramus such as a priest of some derelict, decadent religion would believe that man has a soul copyright, so to speak, on souls. Consider this: UFOs are real. There are other people in space, people so highly evolved, so highly intelligent, that intelligent humans now are by comparison to these space people as stupid as a dress shop dummy, you know, one of those plaster or plastic figures standing stiffly in the dress with some hideous frocks tuck on over it. One of the reasons why religious bodies deny the existence of UFOs is because their very presence shows that man is not the ultimate form of evolution. If the priests are right and man is the ultimate form of evolution, then what are these people in space? They are real people, they are intelligent people, and some of them are spiritual people. They have souls, they too go to the astral worlds just as do humans, just as do animals, cats, horses, dogs, etc. Very definitely, very emphatically, and speaking with the utter knowledge of one who does astral travel as a matter of course, let me tell you this, yes, my friend, your pet lives in another sphere, lives in good health and in better shape, even more pleasant to look at, perhaps even missing you, but now with the knowledge that you can meet again, for, as in the case of humans, if you really love your pet and your pet really loves you, you can and you will meet again. Let me tell you that Mrs. Fifi Grey Whiskers, my truly beloved friend, left this earth some time ago. She is still my beloved friend and I can visit her in the astral. And Miss Kue also left this world when she was badly upset by another attack of press persecution. Miss Kue was ill at the time and these moronic press people thundering around upset her, and, well, she left me. I was sad, sad for myself, sad that I could no longer cradle her in my arms, but glad that she had relief from the sorrows and utter miseries which she and I had endured together on this earth. I tell you, I meet her in the astral, so I am in a very, very definite position to tell you that the priests are wrong. Mankind is not the epitome of spiritual development. Some animals are far more spiritual than man. Let us close this chapter, then, with a repetition of that statement. I repeat, yes, all you who grieve for those little pets who have left this earth and gone on beyond, grieve no more, for if you love your departed pet and that pet loves you, you will be together again beyond the confines of this earth, just as Mrs. Fifi Grey Whiskers and the Lady Kue and I meet so often in the astral, and as we shall be together on a much more permanent basis when, may it be soon, this life on earth ends for me. And when there is a cessation of press persecution and hostility, when there is a cessation of pain and misery which long drawn out illness causes. Chapter 2. The old man shifted wearily in the uncomfortable wheelchair. No springs, he muttered, even a baby carriage has springs, yet the ones who are sick have to jog along as comfortlessly as in a farm cart. It had been a cheerless day, and one which was far from ended. Letters, and more letters. All of them wanting you are my father and my mother, said the letter from Africa, and I love you like my best girlfriend. Now I want to come and tell you so. Will you send me a free return ticket so that I may? And at the same time send the fare so that I can see my sister who lives in Los Angeles. I shall expect this by return and will kiss the dust at your feet. The old man sighed ruefully and set the letter aside. Thinks I'm a millionaire, does he? He asked the little girl cat purring alongside. Old Maggie was out of the mental hospital again and had resumed her barrage of unwanted love letters. Old Maggie. The woman who journeyed to this Canadian seaport and told people she was employed by the old man. Said she was employed by him, ran up a bill for $168 in his name and sent a frightened hotel manager to the old man for the money. Money which was not forthcoming. I have never even seen the woman, said the old man, and she deluges me with letters which I tear up. No, I have no work, or money, for her. So old Maggie cheerfully admitted that she had just left a mental home, and she was deported back to one. Mrs. Horst's letter, too, was a bother. 22 pages of it. All questions. Questions which would need a book to answer, this book, Mrs. Horst. Dear, dear. Mrs. Horst, the lady who had things written to her in words of one syllable and who still managed to read the wrong meaning in everything. Yes, the old man was weary. The day was long and the letters were longer. Outside, the summer weather of deep, deep fog swirled blackly, smearing windows with a greasy scum, and hiding the ramshackle buildings near the waterfront. Somewhere out in the fog a ship hooted mournfully, as if in despair at having to enter this moribund seaport where the water stank to high heaven with the discharging effluvia of a nearby pulp mill. The old man grunted far, what a stench! And turned to signing the letter, all 43 of them. The little girl cat stood up, arched her back and said before going off to her tea. The littlest girl cat was still abed, recovering from a chill easily induced by the damp fog and intense humidity of these summer days. The wheelchair groaned in dismay beneath the 260 pounds of weight as the old man turned to switch on the lights. "Lights," he muttered, "lights, are they really necessary at 5 in the afternoon of Midsummer's Day?" The years bore down heavily, years of suffering, years of sorrow, years made even more sorrowful by the cowardly men of the press who always printed lies, being strangers to the truth, and who never dared afford an opportunity for a reply to their columns. Cowardly men, despicable men, who live by pandering to their readers' worst emotions, who drag down culture instead of helping it up. The dreary evening slowly wore on. The faintest of faint glows showed that somewhere outside the fog and shrouded windows street lamps were alight. Eerie crawling glimmers, like fireflies afar, showed that late workers were making their slow way home behind straining headlights. At last it was late enough to retire. The old man trundled his wheelchair to the side of the hard, hard bed and climbed in. With a sigh of relief he settled back. "Now for freedom," he thought, "freedom to wander at will throughout the world by astral travel." For some moments he rested, lost in thought, then, the night's journey decided upon, he relaxed for the preparatory stages. Soon there came the familiar slight jerk, almost a start as if one had been frightened, and with the slight jerk the astral body shook free from the physical. Shook free and drifted upwards, higher and higher. The fog was all around the harbor. A few miles further out the fog thinned and was gone. At the airport the lights were on and the infrequent aircraft were still able to make their landings. Out in the Bay of Fundy a large oil tanker rode at its moorings, rode at anchor, its riding lights swaying slightly as the ship heaved to the change of the tide. Aboard the oil ship men were still playing, gambling with packs of cards before them, and piles of money on the floor. They seemed happy enough, although impatient to get ashore to whatever entertainment this poor port could offer them. Entertainment? What sort of entertainment does the average sailor want? And that can be found in even the poorest of ports, and the poorer the port the cheaper that form of entertainment, although possibly the dearest in the end. The old man, not old any longer now that he was not encumbered by an ailing body and a creaking wheelchair, drifted along across the Bay of Fundy. He stopped a while at the little town of Digby nestling between hills, a quaint little place, one which it would be nice to visit in the flesh because in the astral colors are rather different. It's like taking off smoked glasses and seeing things as they are. From Digby, on to Yarmouth to look at that little place with its narrow streets and crowded houses. Seemed to be just one main street with a few scattered houses around. And, oh yes! Exclamation mark! A shockingly crazy woman lived down there. Move on to Halifax. A slight pause, and the ground blurred beneath, blurred with the speed of travel. And then the lights of Halifax came swiftly into view. Halifax. What an unfriendly city, what a horrible city, was the personal opinion of the old man floating above. He thought for a moment of that stupid old biddy at the airport who said she was a good Catholic, and they didn't want heathens in clean Halifax. Still, that's in days gone by. Today is today, and tomorrow, well, a few miles further on and we shall be in tomorrow. So a circle around Halifax, passing the big Paragon buildings, passing over the naval station and the Bedford Basin, seeing the lights at Winkle on the wooded slopes flanking Bedford Basin. The lights of the rich people, the ones who could just buy and order what they like, the ones who could get medical attention and not count the cost. Not like the old man who, because he was so sick, couldn't get insured with the Blue Cross or the Green Shield, or whatever it is. They all seemed to want their cake and eat somebody else's. So the old man could not afford medical attention in young, bustling Canada, and so he suffered because of lack of money. Because of lack of medical attention which he could not afford. So thinking he rose higher and higher, rose up to where he could see the sunlight and sped on across the Atlantic. Soon a satellite came hurtling by, a satellite reflecting bright silver as it caught the rays of the sun. But the old man wasn't bothered by satellites, or anything of that nature. They were too common, too usual. He sped on and overtook an Air Canada plane shrieking its way across the Atlantic bound for, where? Shannon? Prestwick? Or possibly going straight to I.E. Bourget in France. Astral travel has many advantages. The plane was overtaken, and passed with no more than a glance in the cabin windows where all the tourist and economy passengers were sitting, three abreast, on both sides of the aisle, with a blue light which simulated night shining dimly down upon them. Some were there with their mouths wide open. And there along the other aisle was a woman with her mouth wide open and her skirts up round her thighs, sound asleep she was, oblivious of the interested gaze of the young man beside her who was wishing that there was more light. In the pilot's cabin, the captain at the controls was smoking his pipe and looking like a placid old cow seen in an Irish field. His co-pilot, sitting beside him, was looking bored to tears. And the flight engineer, behind them and to the right, was holding his head in his hands as if life was just too insupportable. On sped the old man, far outstripping the speed of the plane which was lumbering behind at perhaps 600 or 700 miles an hour. And soon, over the curve of the horizon, came the loom of the lights of London and the flashing beacon which was London Airport. Here, in London, the streets were by no means deserted, although it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, a fine morning too. Busy work gangs were moving about sweeping the streets, clearing up the litter, and here and there manholes in the streets were opened and little frames with red flags above them prevented the unwary from falling down. Here were the sewer men carrying out their nightly inspection. Deep underground while the rest of London slept. But how London has changed, the old man thought. This great building stretching up and up. But then he remembered. Oh, yes. Of course, that is the new post office tower, supposed to be the highest in England. Thoughtfully, interestedly, he circled around it and saw the men inside more or less killing time. Things weren't very busy at this hour of the night. And then the old man moved on through Victoria Street. A train was just coming into the station and weary passengers were picking up their luggage, and stretching cramped legs. In the taxi ranks the cab drivers were waking themselves up from a light doze, starting their cabs, and waiting for the fares. But the old man drifted along, looking at familiar places in Victoria Street, and then he spied an immense new building, the windows of which overlooked the gardens of Buckingham Palace. What bad taste, he thought, what bad taste. That these building promoters should intrude upon the privacy of the royal family who had done so much for England, even against the active opposition of the press who always take any opportunity, no matter how unjustified, of picking faults with the royal family. A family who has done more for England than any other Englishman or woman. But down below red double-decker buses still roared through the streets carrying night workers to or from their nightly shifts. Perhaps this little jaunt to England should come to an end now, there is so much else to see. But, before leaving England, let us look along the length of Fleet Street again and read some of the early morning headlines. Here it says that the press of England are having a very bad time financially, they cannot put up the price of their papers for people will not pay any more. Sixpence for a newspaper. A lot of money for paper into which one wraps one's fish and chips. Personally, the old man thought, the daily newspapers, the whole bunch of them together, they're not worth a halfpenny. And the sooner they go bankrupt the better for the world, for they generate hate between nations and between peoples. Can anyone truly say the press have ever done any good? So thinking the old man turned his thoughts southwards, and in the astral flight took a wide sweep straight over the English Channel. Straight over Paris, he went, where he just gave a passing glance at the home of De Gaulle the troublemaker before speeding on to South America, to the River Plate, to the land of Uruguay, Montevideo. Here in Montevideo the time was about midnight. The streets were still thronged. Demonstrations were in progress. Students were rioting and even as the old man watched from a few feet above the city a lusty student hand propelled a large rock straight through the face of a clock standing on the sidewalk by a familiar bus stop. There was a shattering of glass and a pfft, and a shower of sparks, and the face of the clock grew dark. No longer did it indicate the hours, the minutes, and the seconds. Around the street corner a gang of grey-uniformed police swirled, sticks in their hands, caps awry, arms outflung to catch any student who came within their reach. The old man floated along thinking of what could have been the future of Uruguay. It could have been a wonderful place. It could have been the garden of South America, supplying exotic fruits to the rest of the world. It could have been the Switzerland of South America, looking after the money and the financial interests of the whole of North, Central, and South America. But the Uruguayans were unequal to the tasks before them, like a man who has never had an illness before and so, not immunized, falls prey to the first slight sickness. Uruguay, with never a bit of suffering, went to pieces when the first storms ruffled their apparently calm surface. The old man thought of a year or so before when he had visited the astral world, and consulted the Akashic record of the probabilities and saw what should have been for Uruguay. The interior of Uruguay is arid because the Uruguayans had cut down all the trees, and the land in the interior is almost barren, almost desert, without water, without vegetation, and seems to be only sun-baked earth which, drying and powdering, blows away at the first puff of wind. The Akashic record of probabilities showed that the Uruguayans should have floated alone in neighboring countries, and should, by carefully controlled atomic blasts, have excavated a great basin perhaps 30 miles by 50 miles in the center. It would have filled from deep wells because the water is there, below the surface. It would have filled, and would have been a wonderful lake, or lagoon, bringing life to the land of Uruguay. Then there would have been trees planted all around the shores of the new lake. And the trees would have brought new atmosphere to a devitalized zone. Soon the land would have flourished. It would have been lush pasture land, rich orchards, and land which would have been the garden of South America. The record of probabilities showed that there would have been a canal leading from the center of the country along to Maldonado, where there is such very deep water and such a very beautiful curve to the shoreline, that it is indeed a natural harbor. The main harbor should have been there, at Maldonado, because the present harbor at Montevideo is silting up, and the whole of the river plate is now a shallow stretch of water, dredged constantly in the ever-shifting sands. But the old man floating above, looking down, thinking of all these things, shook his head with sorrow at the thought that the Uruguayans had not measured up to those things which were probabilities for them and which would have led them so profitably to greatness. The record of probabilities showed that in years to come Australia would have been impressed by such a successful scheme, and would have copied the scheme in the dead heart of Australia, where the furnace-like desert dries up everything. But Australia could be opened up as Uruguay could have been opened up. The old man had seen enough of Uruguay. And so, with just a farewell wave, he lofted higher and higher and sped with the speed of thought across the face of the world. Across oceans, across lands, to another destination. I want you to tell us more about astral travel, how we can do it. You've written about it in You Forever. And in other books, but tell us again. You cannot tell us too much about it, tell us how we can do it. So go the letters. So go the demands. Tell us about astral travel. Actually, astral travel is the simplest of things, so simple that it is surprising that people cannot do it without trying. But we must also remember that walking is simple. Walking is so simple that we can walk in a straight line, or follow a curved path, and we do not have to think about it at all. It comes natural to us. Yet on many occasions a person has been very ill and confined to bed for some months, and the sufferer has then forgotten how to walk. He or she has forgotten how to walk, and has had to be taught all over again. It is the same with astral travel. Everybody could once do astral travel, but for some strange reason they have forgotten precisely how to do it. How do you teach a person how to walk? How do you teach a person, long encased in an iron lung, to breathe? How do you teach a person to travel in the astral? Possibly only by recounting the steps and the process. possibly only by being what some would call repetitious, can one induce a person to teach his or herself how to get again into the astral. Suppose you have a sponge, an ordinary big bath sponge will do, and then you call it the body. Suppose you fill the holes in the sponge with a gas which clings together. That is, it doesn't disperse like most gases do, it hangs together like a cloud. Well, this gas you can call the astral. It is now in the sponge, so you have one entity inside another. The sponge representing the body, and the gas filling the otherwise empty spaces in the sponge and representing the astral body.